We're talking to Terry Miners, who at the time of this recording has been with WHAS Radio and Afternoon Drive for over 20 years. Terry, thanks for talking to us about your time at WHAS and your time in Radidio.
John, I've always loved radio. In fact, some of my best memories are of the time I spent in the studio down the hall from you in Lexington.
That's right. We worked together. You were at WKQQ, and I was at WBLG.
Which I just happened to read something about this morning. It was those were the call letters for a TV station long ago. Apparently, an announcer named Luther Combs passed away, and he worked at WBLG-TV, and I thought, what? Who? What? It's funny how those call letters get bounced around, but I guess I finally figured that out. That stands for bluegrass.
That's right, yeah. It's the call letters, I think, are in Bowling Green now, but the guy who owned WBLG, Roy White, ended up putting WBLG-TV on the air, Channel 62 in Lexington, and which later became WTVQ.
Right. We all get passed around like alphabet soup. The trick is always to remember to say the correct letters of the station that is signing your paycheck.
There you go. That's right. You have to learn how to do that, especially when you're working in clusters these days where there are several different radio stations you might work for. It's always nice to say the right call letters when you're on the right frequency.
Indeed.
Before starting in radio, why did you decide you wanted to be on the radio?
My dad was a truck driver, and he worked hard. I'm one of 14 kids, and my mom was always having to work so hard to keep everything under control in the family, and my dad was busting his hump all the time working as a truck driver, and then he also umpired softball games and published a magazine about the Catholic community in Louisville, and I just know he was always so overwhelmed, and I'd look and see how tired he was, and then I would look and see the guy on TV talking, doing the news, and I thought, you mean I can either put on work boots and leave the house at 2 o'clock in the morning to drive a truck, or I can put on a fancy suit and sit on that electric box and talk and tell people what's happening in the world. That's for me.
So did you start off trying to be on TV first?
No, not really. I became more and more interested in the media, and I liked it. I would pretend to be Bill Bailey, who was the morning man on WAKY in Louisville at that time. And I just loved that a guy could get on the radio and talk about the governor and the mayor and the county judge and, you know, make jokes about them. And that was his job, and I was just fascinated by that. So as a kid, I would sit in my room and play my 45s and pretend to be Bill Bailey and talk. When the music would fade, I would talk, and my brothers would all laugh at me, and I just knew I wanted to do that.
Now, you ended up hanging around that radio station, WAKY, didn't you?
I did. I love wacky radio. When I was in high school, I would hang around there a little bit, and they let me answer phones, and Coyote Calhoun and Chuck Jackson and some of the other fellows. Bill Purdom was a production guy there, an overnight guy. Then, of course, I got to meet the great Bill Bailey. They were so kind to me, and they just kind of took me under their wing, and they taught me how to run some equipment. And then they were good enough to let me go on remotes and hang around and just sort of be a spectator. But they also helped me put together an audition tape. So when I went away to college at the University of Kentucky, they helped me scope together a tape that I'd made in a production room when I really had never been on the air before. But they helped me and sent me off to college with a sack full of audition tapes, even though I'd never really had a job before.
So you ended up at WKQQ in Lexington, right?
Because they took one of my tapes, and the guy who was running the place, Jim Rivers, was very nice. He was in charge of, the on-air side of it, and he needed a kid to come in and run the automation. So that's what they did. They said, you're interested in the business? Well, we've got a job for you. College boy, all night Friday night, all night Saturday night. From 10 p.m. to 7 a.m., you can stay here and change the tapes on the automated WKQQ. And I thought, well, whatever, I'm in. So I'm in the business.
So that was about 1975, right?
Correct. Exactly right.
WKQQ was automated, the leftover automation system from WLEX-TV. It was WLEX-FM, I think, at one time, running the old Drake Chenault format, and then a company bought them and changed the call letters and the format to WKQQ. It was album rock, though, right?
Yeah, it was called Rockin' Stereo. Wasn't that Lee Abrams' deal? He had a whole package. I think it was called Rockin' Stereo, but it was album rock, AOR, album-oriented rock. And it was a great format. You were cool just to say you worked there. And then ultimately they decided to take that station live, and I had never really gotten to do anything. I think I got to voice a couple of commercials. but they hired a staff, and then one of the persons was not capable or was unable to do the job or whatever, and so after a while, I got a shot, and it worked out.
So what was your first air shift on WKQQ?
The first thing I ever did was late at night, I got to come on it for the time change, and it sounded a little bit like this. Hello, it's 2 o'clock in the morning. Well, really, it's 1 o'clock, but it was 2 o'clock, and now it's 1 o'clock. Here's Led Zeppelin. You know, I didn't know what else to say. I was trying to, you know, get all technical about it, but really, I was just thrilled to be able to turn the mic on and roll the pot, turn the pot up just to say something. I was so thrilled. And that was all I was allowed to do that first night. And I did a splendid job of it.
You mentioned Jim Rivers. There was a Louisville connection there. He worked at the old WKLO in Louisville.
Right. I loved he and his wife. They were so kind to me, you know, because I was an 18-year-old idiot. I'm a 50-year-old idiot now, but they were just nice to me. And Jim taught me stuff about radio, and I just appreciated their openness and kindness.
Now, eventually, you got off that all-night show and worked into something more regular.
Yeah, I did. I worked into the afternoons. They put me in the afternoons on that station for a little bit, and then I did the morning show, and then I did middays, and then I'd had enough. It was about 4 years later, and I just said, you know what, I'm just tired of being on the air. I don't feel like my life's progressing. Although a few times I had fun, I would use sound effects and pretend like during long records I was mowing the lawn. You would hear a song starting and say, they've got me mowing the front lawn. Then you'd hear, and then I'd start up and pretend like I was going out front to mow the grass around the tower. And then as the record faded out, you'd hear the lawnmower roll back up and then turn off. And then I'd act like I was out of breath and talk about some dog that had chased me or whatever. And so I got to play a little bit on there. And no one really gave me any lip about it. I just did those sorts of things every now and then, just pretending with sound effects that there was more going on there than there really was. I'm sure I'd heard it or seen it in a movie or something somewhere and thought, you know, I can make this a little bit more interesting. And no one really seemed to care at that time, so I was just experimenting, and it gave me a little freedom. But for the most part, I became tired of it and decided in 1980 I was going to go run a grocery store in Indianapolis. My brother owned it, so I quit radio, went up to Indianapolis in about June, and by, Labor Day, I guess I'd been robbed about 3 times.
Oh, man.
You know, it was just a tough deal, and I just thought, this is not for me. Someone stole a case, not a carton, a case of cigarettes from our store, which I don't know what it was worth at the time, but it seemed like it was enough money to buy a house. But yeah, somehow the back door of the store was open, and a case of cigarettes, I don't know how many cartons that is, but a lot, stolen. And I just remember thinking, oh, my God, we'll have to have the store open for the next month just to make the profit back that we just lost by that. And I just thought, this is crazy. And so I called some stations in Louisville, and WLRS Louisa Henson hired me as a promotions person because I said, please, I don't want to be on the air anymore. I've just had enough of that. So promotions were open, and I took that. And then, of course, at WLRS, somebody would get sick or something. They'd say, Terry, you know how to be on. Go on in there. Do the evenings. Go on in there and do the afternoon. Go on and, you know, whatever. Somebody wasn't there, and so I'd do that a little bit. And then, you know, I started having fun with it again. And then the morning show at the time was Ron Clay and Dan Burgess, who's a great guy. We're still friends. And he and Ron would joke around a little bit on the morning show, and they were kind of goofing it up a little bit and getting a little bit of attention. But Dan got tired of that and wanted to be a real newsman, and so he went to WHAS, and then they put me on the mornings with Ron, and we decided we would make it a little wilder show and call it Morning Sickness. Then we really took off because he and I had different, diverse personalities. He was more of a hippy-dippy guy, and I was kind of the uptight, necktie-wearing nerd. And the combination of our personalities made for great fodder. And, of course, we were playing it up a little bit. Ron and I were crazy about each other, but we played it up to be the nerd and the cool guy sort of thing. And Ron, sort of being 7 years older, he was able to sort of school me into the party ways of life. And we had a great show, and it upset our competition, which at the time was WQMF, and they were playing music in the morning. And we were playing music. But on LRS, we were able to stretch ourselves creatively and do a lot of really wild stuff. And then they put us on a cable channel in the morning. They set up a TV studio in our on-air radio studio, lights and all that business, and a two-camera shot, and decided that we would be on cable TV simultaneously. But while our music was playing on the radio, we would continue to be open mic'd on the cable television channel.
Wow.
And we were allowed more latitude on cable TV, of course, so we used that to our advantage. And we sort of started a secret little club with the viewers of the cable TV show, as though they were getting something that no one else knew about. And it really grew into something. It grew like wildfire, but we could make really rougher jokes on the cable than we could on the radio. Just more pointed things, a little harsher comedy, let's just put it that way. And it did create a groundswell of interest in us that grew like wildfire. QMF, meanwhile, was seeing its numbers fade in the morning, so they decided they were going to hire us away. And they did. And we worked a deal with them. Oh, by the way, on the cable TV thing, they had already stopped that by the time we left WLRS. They came to us one day and said, fellas, we're going to have to pull the plug on this cable TV thing. The local cable company decided they're going to replace you with something called MTV. And we said, what?
That'll never work.
That's what happened to that cable channel. I think it was like WLRS Cable or something. They'd come up with some kind of a name, and we did play music videos after our morning show was over. We had a guy that ran it, but MTV ultimately took that slot. So we did go to QMF. We got more money. We were sued by WLRS.
Let me ask you about that. How much money did it take you to go across the street?
I was making about $18,000, and then all of a sudden I went to $25,000 because some other company was interested in us. And then I went to $32,000.
So that was real money in the early 80s.
That's right. So I went from 18 to 32 in a period of about 2 months. So I almost doubled my money. And that was, 1982.
Did you have a contract with LRS?
No. We had talked about maybe putting one together. And that was LRS's argument for Ron and me. This was interesting, though. Ron was an Indiana resident, so the legal system was unable to throw a net over him as easily as it was me, a Kentucky resident, because the station was licensed in Kentucky. I don't know how that came into play, but it did. So we did agree to go to QMF for $32,000, and then I made $40,000 a year later. So he gave us a nice raise after the first year because it was so successful.
And LRS wasn't able to counter. It was just too much.
Oh, we didn't want their counter. We wanted to switch. We just thought it would be fun to do the whole deal. So they met us at the Bristol restaurant on Bardstown Road. They called me in the afternoon. I called Ron. I did all the negotiating because I would just call Ron. He'd say, Ron was a really low-key, mellow guy, and he'd just say, whatever you think's best, man. He didn't care. And I didn't mean to hurt anybody at WLRS's feelings, but I just thought that this was a new adventure for us and that ultimately we'd already made them mad by negotiating with the other station, so I felt like the marriage was never going to be placid again. And, you know, the Henson family has been wonderful to me over the years. They were mad for a while, but they got over it. They're good people. They're just high-quality people, the whole family. And I didn't want to hurt anybody's feelings, but I just thought it would be a new, exciting adventure. But we met with the QMF people at the Bristol on Bardstown Road, and while we're having dinner negotiating our final deal, in walks Lee Masters, who is the operations manager for WLRS. He looks, and then the owner of QMF says, hello, Lee. I think you know these boys, Ron and Terry. And so he knew right away what was going on. And so we finished the dinner, and we left. And John Otting, the owner of QMF, said, you boys better go clean out your lockers now because it's probably going to get a little ugly. And we went straight to WLRS that evening. It was probably 8 o'clock at night, and by the time we got to the building, Miss Henson, Louisa Henson, was there, and she was standing in a doorway with her arms and legs in each corner. She said, don't go past me. Don't touch me. And we just said, well, I just want to get my stuff and leave. And she didn't want us to take our stuff, so it was a little contentious there for a while. Then finally, she calmed down a little and let us go take our stuff. I tried to leave my house in the morning to go to WQMF to start right away the next morning. And there was a guy sitting in front of my house all night calling. He kept calling and calling, asking if I was there. And my girlfriend at the time said, no, he's not here. Well, I was in there hiding. I knew what he wanted. He was going to serve me with a judge's order to keep me from going on the air, cease and desist order. Ron Clay, meanwhile, is in Indiana where he can't be served. It's a different system. They got a judge to sign a thing that night, but Ron's over in Indiana, and they don't know how to find him. So Ron made it to QMF fine. QMF, by the way, their studio was in Indiana at the time, so he could get there without any problem. I, however, lived in a duplex. I called the woman who lived downstairs and said, can I use your car? And she just loved the whole, you know, the whole Mission Impossible angle of it. So I sneaked down a back staircase into the woman's apartment below, and she gave me her keys, and I took her car out of the back and drove away and went to QMF, and we went on the air, and we pretended like it was a military invasion and with sound effects and everything, and we overthrew their morning man. Rock and Roll Jones was his name, and took him hostage, and we took over QMF. Well, of course, the TV stations come running. They're all shooting video, and we're the number one story in the news because we've overtaken another radio station, and it went on pretty well. And then finally, they taped a cease and desist order on the front door of the QMF studios, and after we were on the air for about 2.5 hours, the owners of QMF came in and said, okay, that's enough. We've gotten enough publicity out of it. And so we had to go to court that day, and a judge ruled that we did not have a binding verbal agreement with WLRS. We were allowed to go sign with QMF and change stations. However, the names of our show and sketches remained the intellectual property of WLRS. And so our show Morning Sickness was no longer, and from that point on we called our new show The Show with No Name, since the show name was taken away from us. And then we just altered the names of the sketches slightly so people knew what they were.
Cool, cool. How long were you at the LRS?
3 years.
And QMF?
2.5.
Okay.
When all that happened was the beginning of 1983, and when it got to be the middle of 1985, someone called me from HAS, a sales guy, and he said, I think the afternoon show's opening up. Apply for it.
Who was doing afternoons at HAS?
Bill Cody was leaving to go to WCII, or maybe he was going to Nashville. I can't remember at the time. He's still in Nashville now. But I sent WHAS a letter because I just thought, well, I've done this morning show thing long enough. I want to do something a little more grown up. The Bingham family owns WHAS and the Courier-Journal and WHAS-TV. You know, it's a rock-solid family organization. They will own it forever. It'll be an incredible family legacy thing, so that's where I want to go. So I sat down and wrote a letter to the WHAS program director, 84 reasons why you should hire Terry Miners. And then I made up 84 different things, and I sent it to him, and he told me later, Denny Nugent told me later, he said, as soon as I opened that and saw what you had done, he said, I knew I was going to hire you.
Wow.
He wound up moving on to Cleveland because I had a six-month non-competition clause. He moved on to Cleveland, and I never really worked for him. He was gone before I went on the air, as was the station manager of WHAS that hired me. He was gone by the time I got on there. He got into a big controversy with the University of Kentucky, and they ultimately pushed him out. So the two guys who hired me at HAS were gone before I actually got on the air. But it all worked out fine. Here it is 22 years later.
So what did you do for those 6 months?
They had me go to work for people. So we would have listeners of the station, since my voice couldn't appear on the air, the other guys could talk about me. And so they'd say, we'll let Terry Miners come do your job for you, and you get the day off work. So I would go and work at a bakery, or I would go along with a package delivery guy, or go to a store and bag groceries, or whatever someone wanted me to do, and then that person would get the day off with pay. That was the goal, that I would come do your job for you.
Wow.
And you would still get paid. The person would get their paycheck. So I did one of those every week, and that was good publicity for the station, and it was a fun thing for the guys on the air to talk about. And then ultimately on December 1st, the six-month non-competition was up, 1985, but that was a Sunday, so I did the Sunday morning talk show as a guest with Doug McKelvin, and then the next day I went on and did my show. And we had a contest on the first day. It was a one-day contest, and here's some good old-school language for you. Send a postcard or a letter and guess the exact date that Terry Miners will be fired or leave WHAS, and you win $500 in cash. But once your date has passed, you're out. We got hundreds of submissions from people guessing when I would be fired or move on. And there are only two cards remaining that are still valid.
Wow.
And, of course, it still works. It's $500. So one guy wrote down the year 8484. And so that's going to be the winner because this other one is up, I think, this year or no, 2010. That's what he wrote, 2010. So it's still a couple of years till that happens. So it's those two people. So if the 2010 date comes and goes and that person's eliminated, I guess we can go on and send the $500 to the other guy.
Well, let's talk about Ron Clay. Ron Clay, of course, passed away a few years ago. How did he take the news that you wanted to be off his morning show and go to WHAS?
I still regret how I handled that. That was a mistake on my part. It hurt Ron's feelings. He was gone that week. That was in May. The HAS people did call me after I sent the letter, and they said, we can't really talk to you because you have a contract. We don't want a legal problem, but the job is open. And if you didn't work at WQMF anymore, I feel really good about the chance that you would get that job. He said something like that. He said it in a way I'm sure a lawyer told him to say it so he wasn't violating some law or whatever. And so I knew what he meant, whatever the inference was. So I knew I had to quit. So I went to the guy who wrote my contract, and he wrote up a letter that said, Terry Miners is ready to resign from QMF. According to his contract, it stipulates, bang, 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 he has a six-month no-compete. He is officially resigning at this moment, but he will stay here for up to six more months as long as his non-competition clause begins winding down immediately. So Terry will stay to help you transition in a new person up to six more months at this rate of pay, but you have to let his non-competition clause start evaporating beginning today. Start counting it down. So that letter was written up by a lawyer, and he gave it to me, and then I walked in. Ron was not with me because he was on vacation that week. I was doing a show by myself. So on Friday morning came, I finished the show. I went into Mr. Otting's office, and I said, can I see you for a minute? And I put the letter down, and he looked at it. He looked down, and he read the letter, and then he looked up at me. And then he looked down, and he looked at it again, and he looked back up at me again, and he said, I think you better leave.
Hmm.
And that was it. And then I turned around and walked away. And John could be very explosive with people, but he was always great to me, always wonderful to me, and that was his way of just saying, I think you better leave because I'm going to blow my stack. And he didn't want to do it in front of me, and so I walked back in the room and got my stuff and walked out, and I never went back again. And by the time I got home, 15 minutes later, the phone was ringing, and it was Bo Wood, who owned WQMF with John Otting at the time. And the Wood family owned WEBN for a long time. Phone rang, and Bo Wood said, you're not going to go to HAS. He said, they're not going to do that. They're just doing that to hurt us. They're going to hire you and then fire you in 6 months just to break up what we've got going here. He said, I'll tell you what, since you have a six-month non-competition, why don't you come up here to Cincinnati and do the morning show on EBN with my sister, Robin Wood? He said, you just be her partner on that show for 6 months. You can come do that instead. And I thought about it. It was very tempting because I loved EBN. And I said, no, I want to do this. I want to go do a grown-up station, a talk show, you know, full-service station like HAS. And he just told me I was making a massive mistake and it was really just a strategic goal of theirs to hurt QMF's growth. So I went home. Then I had to call Ron and tell him after I told Bo Wood, no thanks. And Ron was just crushed. I mean, I just said, Ron, I'm going to leave. I'm going to go take this job. And QMF pretty much told me to beat it today. They didn't want me to stay around, even come back on Monday. And he just said, well, okay, if that's the way you feel, click. And then I thought, oh, well, he'll get better. And he left and went to Sacramento, California. I think he just didn't like the end of our show busting up that way either because we were great. And, you know, it's funny, we were gelling the same time Bob and Tom were, and I'm sure we were going to be on the same kind of growth pattern. We were doing the same type of show. It just wasn't for me anymore. My heart wasn't into it. I just felt like, well, I'm 28 years old, I'm going to try something else. But Ron left because he didn't want to be around and have people saying, oh, your show was better when it was such and such on there instead of this new clown they have on with you. Ron hated Sacramento, so he called Mr. Otting, from what I understand, I'm just going on what I've heard, and said, can I come back? And Otting said, absolutely, and let him come back. And they kept pairing him up with different people, and it just never really was the same. It's just there's a chemistry factor that you cannot manufacture. It just has to be two people's personalities blending to make good comedy. And Ron and I, we didn't really know each other before we started working together, but we just were able to finish each other's thoughts and then accentuate what the other person said because we came from different frames of reference. And I always felt terrible that I didn't tell Ron first, I want to leave this deal, and I kind of left him hanging. I was just dumb. I was 28 years old, and I was thinking about, you know, my own goals without really being sensitive to the fact that I was disrupting his life. And he's a married guy with two kids, and, you know, it was selfish of me. And I saw Ron a couple of years later. He'd been to Sacramento. He came back. He was back on QMF. He had some partner that wasn't funny. Ron was funny, though, the whole time. He was just Ron. But his partners just didn't quite work well. He had some good ones. Troy Roebuck, I know, was very good. Mason Lee Dixon, the wacky legend, he was good. It just wasn't the same. You know, it was like you can't recreate the wheel. You can only do that once. And so anytime they would put together a new team, it was just something less than what there was before. But those guys are talented just in their own way. And I saw Ron one day at an event where they were broadcasting, and I went over and said, hey, and tried to give him a hug or something, and he was better. He smiled at me and shook my hand and said, you know, I'm doing all right. And I noted that Ron was holding his ribs. We had played in a football game. We invited listeners to come out and play a touch football game. We played it in the front yard of Yum World Headquarters, which is KFC, Taco Bell, Pizza Hut, all that business off of the Waterson Expressway and Newburgh Road. We had all these listeners come out, and we were going to play a big touch football game. This was late in my career at QMF. And a couple guys got rough with us and knocked us down. You know, it was just, they were having fun. But I noticed after that, Ron was holding his ribs a little bit, like he'd been bruised or something. But then, months later, he was holding his ribs still. And then when I saw him a year or two later, after he'd been to Sacramento for a short time and back, he still would hold his ribs some of the time. Well, I didn't realize that he was sick. It wasn't an injury from that football game. He had lymphoma. He didn't know it for a long time. And then I know he tried a lot of alternative medicine and different remedies to try and help himself, and nothing was working. He went to a sweat tent, which is really a primitive sort of ritualistic thing where you go into this tent and they have these fires lit, and it's as though they pray to spirits to make your illness go away. I mean, he would do those kinds of things. And once I heard Ron was sick, I was contacting him, and he would talk to me, but only briefly. And then a woman I knew whose daughter was a nurse came to me one day, and she said, your buddy's in trouble. He's a goner. That's the expression she used. He's a goner. And I said, no. They said he's doing better. She said, nope, he's a goner. So I called him that day, and I said, hey, Ron, you know, I'd like to come see you and just talk with you for a little bit. You know, I guess I just wanted to square up what had happened several years earlier. And he said, oh, no. He said, I'm fine. And his voice was really bad then. Oh, no. He said, I'm fine. I just took another test, and they said, I'm doing fine. I'm going to be fine. Thanks for calling. Click. And he was dead a week later.
Wow.
And it was like, you know, I'm so sorry that I hurt his feelings by quitting that show so much that he never would look at me much again. It was just, I didn't mean anything personal, but I was wanting to work out my own life. And, you know, we were thrown together in a haphazard fashion originally, and it did help, and it did boost my career, and it boosted his, too. What I'm mostly sick about is that his life ended at such a young age. I'm 50 years old now. He died at, I think he was only 42. He was in his early 40s. And, you know, I think I've already lived that much longer than Ron, and no one deserves that. I mean, he's a good, kind, sweet person and wouldn't hurt a flea, but that's a big hole in my heart that I never really was able to go look him in the eye and say, I'm sorry, I mishandled that.
All right, you go to WHAS. Did they offer you a contract right off the bat?
Yes. They offered me the same money I made at QMF. They were great to me. I got on the air in December of 85, and then it was a big hit. I got lots of publicity, and that's what they wanted, and it helped that stodgy image of that station by having somebody who was considered young then, 28 years old, to be on there with those old fogies. And they called me in a year later and gave me $5,000 and said, we've underpaid you.
Wow.
I've just never heard of such a thing. They were paying me $40,000, and they gave me a $5,000 gift. just because they say we're underpaying you.
They obviously weren't owned by Clear Channel at the time.
That was the Binghams, but they were for sale at this time because they sold them in 86. So I was only there a year before the sale transition began, and then I think it took a whole year for a transition. So really a couple of years under Bingham ownership. And then, but Clear Channel, I got to say, was great to me. It has been terrific to me. They've been very kind. You know, we were one of the early acquisitions for them. So Lowry Mays knows who I am, and I mean, I can email him today, and he responds. And Mark Mays and those guys, because they only had a smattering of stations at the time. Well, now they've got, you know, 1,200 stations. They don't know all their employees, but they've been great to me, and they gave me stock early on, and it really helped me with, you know, getting my life, you know, really financially pretty stable. And so I appreciated their kindness to me. So they've been wonderful to me. It's just the business has changed so much in the last 4 or 5 years that it's a different dynamic. It wouldn't have worked the same way had I made a transition now than I did then. I mean, if I was 28 years old and I was coming over here now, it would just be a different sort of a thing. But I love our business. Whatever it is, whatever phase it's in, we can all look back and think that yesterday was always greater than it is today, but I don't feel that way. I just feel like you make what you can out of what you have each day. And there's a path to success on whatever level that is, and I don't necessarily mean financial, I mean on whatever level. It's inner peace, success, every day for every person in every business. But I love our business, even though it's changed so drastically. It's still compelling, rewarding, wonderful, and I can't wait to go at it every single day.
That's a great attitude, and to be at the same radio station in the same air shift for over 20 years, that's kind of a rarity, especially these days.
Well, I consider the people that I work with as great support system for me, and then I do that for them. I mean, we are all part of each other's lives, and so I've enjoyed being in my hometown, being around my own family, you know, my nuclear family from growing up, and then my own family here, and then having people that I've been around for, many of them, for 12, 14 years, however long they've been there. And so, you know, I've been there for births of babies and deaths in family and trouble, and so I don't want to go anywhere else. I feel like I'm part of a network that is like an accordion. It, you push in when you need help, and you pull out and you help them when they need you. And that's the beauty of being around the same pocket of people for decades, is that they know your weaknesses, they know your strengths, they know when you need them, and I know when they need me.
Let's talk about the WHAS Terry Miner Show. How does it all come together each day? What kind of preparation is involved? And the second part of the question would be, how has it changed from 1985 to today?
There was music in the beginning. I would play, and Denny Nugent told me when he hired me, I don't care if you play any music at all. Just do your thing, and it's really flexible. And the good news is, they've been flexible with me the whole time. They just sort of let me evolve things the way I want throughout the years. They had music, and then they dumped it, I don't know, 7, 8, 9 years ago, whenever. So that changed the texture of my show because I had had more talk elements. And I like that. In the beginning, I was doing a couple little bits an hour and playing music and then tossing to the sports guy or the weather guy or whatever. They've added more service elements over the years, too, because that's how we fight iPods and satellite radio, is that we have local content providing ongoing information on a local basis as much as we can, and that separates us from our competition. And so we've added on a lot more people with local information, and so that has changed it drastically, as opposed to before when I just totally had an open chart to do whatever I wanted all the time. I still have that, but it's in different compartments because of the local service elements. I still do a lot of comedy stuff in there, but I do a lot of serious stuff, too. I mean, I interview senators. I interview people who are dying. There are some pretty heavy-duty things that go on there sometimes, too. And then every day I do a thing where I reward someone who does their exercise, just because we're such a slovenly nation. I try to remind people every day, just a 15-minute walk can extend your life by, who knows, 15 months, 15 years. I mean, when it comes down to the end of your life, if you could have 15 more days and you could have them just because you decided to walk a little bit every day, wouldn't everybody trade for that? You betcha. You just have to remind people they have to think about it now. It's like a savings account. You got to put the money in now to get the dividend later. So I do a little bit of that little, I guess, motivating talk. I love parodying stuff that's going on in the news right now. Britney Spears has a shaved head, and Larry Burkhead, he's from Louisville. He's squabbling to get that baby that Anna Nicole Smith left behind. We had a woman who is one of the potential anchors for the Today Show. They were getting guests to be anchor for a day, and she was cut this morning. So I'm going to have to talk with her this afternoon, and that's not going to be as happy a conversation as I was intending, because I thought she was going to make it and become the chosen one to be the guest anchor on the Today Show. But I've been talking with her every day. So I kind of keep up with little stories, with little soap operas that are going on with people in Louisville. There's a woman who walks a lot, and she finds money. Well, I'm going to go out and do a road show with her soon where I walk with her. She's found over $8,000 over the last 20 years by walking. Change. Of course, one time she found several hundred dollars in one sitting, which we think might have been like somebody robbed a liquor store and threw the money out the car window when they saw a police officer or something, and she found it. But I find little oddball people and their odd stories, and then, you know, talk with them on the air. There are always eccentric personalities in every city, and if you just sort of keep your ear to the ground, you'll find them, and they love sharing their stories. There's one guy, his name is Robley Rex. He's 105 years old, and he works at the Veterans Hospital. He himself is a World War I veteran. Well, about a month ago, an article was published. I think maybe I saw it online. Last World War I vet passes away. Well, naturally, I freak out. I look at the copy, and it's a guy in California who passed away at age 106 or whatever, and I thought, oh, my God, Robley must have died. I didn't see it. Maybe I was out of town or something. So I immediately call Robley Rex's number. It's ring, ring. I did not do this on the air, of course. I want to find out if my buddy was okay. So I'm in the production studio. Ring, 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 and then finally you hear the phone click, and he says, hello! And I went, thank God! So I thought, well, the headline's wrong, and thank God for it. Then I explained to the audience why I was panicking. I read the headline, and then I called Robley, and I let him hear that. But once I knew he was okay, that was all right. And by the way, Robley Rex, that day, we got on and talked about, I said, what do you do at the Veterans Hospital? Explain to people what you do. You're 105. He said, well, I push a man in a wheelchair. And here's the way he said it. I'm paraphrasing, but here's the way he said it on the radio. This was a couple months ago. He said, well, let's say we got a man in here, and his name's Terry Miners, and we take him, and here's a guy, he's 105, he remembers my name and remembers to interject it in the middle of a conversation. He's a great storyteller. I just can't believe that someone of that advanced age is that sharp in the brain. And I said, Robley, how in the world does a 105-year-old man push another man in a wheelchair? He said, well, I usually go to the guy who's in the wheelchair and say, can you hold my walker? Can you picture that? He's got the guy holding his walker while he pushes him in the wheelchair. Oh, gosh. Anyway, that's the kind of stuff that I think makes radio so great and so intimate, is that you find people with stories, and they just have something funny to tell. And if they can tell it in a colorful way, it helps people create pictures in their minds, and it makes Robley Rex that much more charming, because we can all see his skinny little 105-year-old body pushing that wheelchair with that other fellow holding his walker. And, you know, that to me is a great radio segment. And then there are a lot of kids that come on, and they have a little bit of talent, and I like letting them showcase it. And I let teams come in who've won the cheerleading championship or the softball thing, and they get their moment in the sun. And then, for the most part, I have a lot of pop culture stuff, things on funny songs or parodies, and we still do impressions of sports figures around here and the various political leaders. And when I walk into a party and the governor or the mayor or somebody's there, usually they'll say, hey, how you doing? You no good, you know, whatever. They always know, they hear that they've been lampooned or whatever, but most of them take it in stride.
Let's talk about the parodies, the things that are pre-recorded. Now, how do those happen? Because, a lot of people don't realize that you just don't sit down at 3 o'clock and this stuff just magically appears on the radio, what kind of prep work is involved as far as getting the voices and scripts and sound effects and producing the thing?
I have several people who do voices, but one guy is my primary voice guy. His name is Jeff Ketterman. He replaced Randy Davidson, who was my partner for many years. Randy tired of the whole industry, the whole corporate industry deal, and he runs a studio out of his house now. We haven't done characters with him for years, but we did keep a couple of the characters and let the next guy do those voices too, and it's worked really well.
Let's talk about Randy Davidson, because you and I worked together with him in Lexington.
Right.
He was known as Dan Davidson then.
Right.
How did you guys connect at WHAS?
I had already known him from, like you said, in Lexington, and we worked around each other, and he was a singer, and I went to see him sing several times. I just liked him. He's a good person. So he was already working in the HAS building when I came there in 85. And so he and I talked about a couple of different little character things, and we made up Buzz Baxter as my announcer. And Buzz was a real radio announcer fellow who over-enunciates everything. Although we made him a mama's boy who lives in his mother's basement. His mother gets the morning paper in every morning and cuts out the articles that she doesn't want him to see because she tries to protect him from the ills and evils of the world. In fact, in one of our show intros, Buzz Baxter will come on for his segment and say, "This show my mother is hating. She thinks Terry Miners is Satan." And so it was always about, "Mother says I have to quit this job because she heard you say dang it the other day, and she said that's a curse word." So his mother was always scolding him about working around me, the demon from the FM. We kept that character going for a long time, but I let that character go when Randy left. I didn't want someone else to take that away because that was kind of an invention of Randy's and mine that really I think only one person could do. But several of the other voices of other pop culture icons, in local and national, we let another guy take over because he could do them pretty well. And Randy is immensely talented. You'll hear him voice commercials in town here still. And like I said, a singer and just a good person. He's a good dad. He loves his daughter, and he and Kathy dote on their daughter, and she's college age now. And so he's enjoyed, I think, kind of being a bit of a stay-at-home dad because he's been able to work a lot out of his house and be there raising his daughter. And I saw him a couple of months ago in a coffee shop, and, you know, I love him. He's just a great guy. And this guy who does voices currently for me primarily, his name is Jeff Ketterman. He's very talented. He does several of the characters Randy used to, and then he does a lot of other ones that we've kind of invented over the last 7-8 years that he's done it. And there's always a way to get a point across by using a character instead of being blunt and just turning it into a rant from me personally, which I think is much less effective. When you're trying to drive home a point, you hand it to a character, and a character has an attitude anyway. So Jeff does like a spinster woman. He does an Al Sharpton type character, and he does an Elvis impersonator, and he does Jay Leno for me. He does current President Bush. He does Bill Clinton. Oh, he does several other characters. But I write for that character and generally write a lot of stuff on Mondays. Mondays I sort of set up the week and write, like yesterday was Monday. I know this is a recorded conversation, but yesterday I wrote 11 pieces. I was actually in Florida yesterday morning and got here in time for the show, but I wrote starting at 6 in the morning in Florida, wrote on the airplane, and then got here, emailed the stuff to him. He met me 45 minutes later, and we banged them out in about an hour and 15 minutes. And then I went right on the air and used 3 of them, and the other 8 are for other days of this week. But they're things that will work into suspected events that will happen, just things that are scheduled, and you suspect that they will happen, but something could always change. And if they change, we can alter the pieces or edit them. But for the most part, things work out fine. Life is so cyclical and predictable. There are so many things you can prepare for in advance. And then each day, I do certain voices of characters that I can do with immediacy. If something happens at 4:30, I can slide into a news studio or another studio in our building while the news is on and record a character doing something about something that's just transpired so that you're right on top of it. And that's very helpful. So the show is very breathable. I'm never very regimented about anything. Oftentimes, I may have something scheduled, tell my producer, hey, we're going to do such and such here at 12 after, okay. And then somebody that I know walks in the front door, somebody who I know is good on the air, and they're coming in, and they're not really scheduled, but I just put them on, and then we bounce things around. So it's not as tightly regimented as most TV shows and certainly most radio shows, but that's the way my personality works best. It's just kind of on the fly.
Real quickly, you mentioned Bill Bailey at the beginning of this interview. Mm-hmm. Now, there's a Bill Bailey connection in your life today still.
There is. Bill's daughter dates one of my golf buddies, and Steve is his name, Steve Schultz, and Bill's daughter's name is Shelley. Steve and I play golf a lot of times, and we're members of the same golf club, Valhalla Golf Club, and he would always keep me updated on what's happening with Bill's health. And then once, a couple of years ago, I said, Bill's slipping, it's not going well. So I went out to see Bill. I was just so moved by him. He was so great to me. And he and I had the best conversation. So I wrote this article and posted it on my website, Come Home, Bill Bailey. And it started a whole lot of response, people finding Bill, sending him cards, and he was so touched. And since then, I've been going back to see him. This is, I don't know, maybe almost 2 years ago. And he's gotten so many cards from people and so many visits from guys, including yourself. His daughter has told me that she thinks it saved his life, that he realized how many people loved him and cared about him and how many people he mentored without even knowing it. That there are so many people that hold him in this worshipful realm that it's given him the drive to want to stay alive. And he's doing great, but it's been these wacky KLO reunion things have really helped. It's reminded him of the value of his work. Because like me, Bill Bailey feels like your radio work kind of goes up in the air, just up in a wisp of smoke. It's gone. It's not like you created a beautiful painting that's hanging in a museum, or you built a beautiful piece of furniture that is sitting there for your grandchildren to enjoy someday. When you talk on the radio, it just sort of evaporates. And that's not really true. But you can feel that way if you're, I don't know, if you're not feeling at your most positive. And Bill and I have that in common, is where we've got to hold on to the fact that hopefully there's somebody there paying attention to what we're saying and is learning from us. Because I learned from Bill. And there have been kids who've come along with me and sat in with me and said, you know, I want your job. I want to do what you do. I'm fascinated by what you do. And then a couple times I've seen those kids later on, and by golly, they've got jobs in radio. And I'm glad. It makes me happy that they took an interest in it. And so Bill Bailey, as a guiding light for me, is still relishing his life. He's still in that home, Friendship Manor, and he does have some physical problems now and again. But he listens to his radio. He's back into listening to guys who are on the air to see what they're up to. And all the attention from the wacky KLO reunions that you organized, John, has really helped reacquaint himself with his love of broadcasting and his love of people in general.